My name is Megan Vigent. I'm 32 years old. Today is May 9th, Friday, 2014. We're at the Camden Library, and I'm sitting here with Paul Marshall, who is a friend of mine, but I'm also helping him write a book. So I'm kind of his editor. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
My name is Paul Marshall, Paul E. Marshall, that is, because there are many of them around. My age is 89, and today's day is May 9th, in 2014. And location, I am at the Camden Public Library, and my relationship to, it says partner, this lady over here is, I am a client of hers in the book making business.
So, Paul, I was thinking, since Mother's Day is coming up, and I know you've talked about your family, but I was thinking about how you are the youngest person in your family, the youngest sibling, and how your brothers and sisters must have, did they take care of you? Were they motherly to you? Or what was your relationship with them like?
With my brothers and sisters?
Yeah.
Well, it's kind of interesting because I am the youngest of 11 children, nine of us. Seven of us who lived, and my older sisters still call me their kid brother. They took care of me in many, many ways. My mother had a house full all the time, and she needed help. My brothers were protective. My next oldest brother, just a year and a half older, we went to schools together, and he was always there, and when I would be in a fight being beaten up by some big boy, he pounced in, and he was my protector. And my oldest brother was my pattern. I wanted to pattern my life after him, I guess.
Why is that? What was his name?
Well, I was always proud of my family. They were always doing good things. They were well-educated. We all worked our way through college together and different times, and we all supported my mother and dad. I had a wonderful family, and it was just helping each other all the time. And it seemed to me that the older ones were patterns that kind of wanted to, you didn't want to be a bad person because that would look at them and say, well, maybe it's their fault, just like my mother and father. I felt that way about them. I patterned myself after them.
So when you were a kid, when you were growing up, did they ever pick on you?
I'm sorry.
Because you were the youngest. Did they ever pick on you, your siblings?
There was none of that in my family. You would have to know my family. We all loved each other, although we never used the word love in the family. It was interesting. But we were always there to help each other and to be together, and we were a happy family. There was no one who felt better than the other or made fun of each other. There was never any fighting or arguing in my family. They never scolded me. My mother and father never scolded me. My mother would simply say, we don't do those things in our family. That was what the family was like.
Can you tell me the story of moving from Patton to Mattawamkeag?
Well, I was born in this little town of Patton, and all of us children were born there. My dad was a woodsman. He went where he could find work in the woods, and we never owned a home, we never owned a car. We had to live in rented houses all the time. My dad was actually operating a portable sawmill, and he moved with that down to the next town 40 miles away, the town of Mattawamkeag. And that was his work, and he thought he would just work there, but then he decided we should move there. So I lived 8 years in the town of Patton. They were wonderful years. We moved to this little town again of Mattawamkeag. Lived there for 8 years, and they were wonderful years. And
tell me about the actual move, like the day that you moved from Patton.
We had no car or anything. My dad had a man who worked with him who had an old beaten-up truck. And when the time came to move, my dad had stayed down to the other town. It was in the wintertime. His helper came up with this big old truck and moved what furniture we had, which was very little, and part of our family. My older brothers and sisters were at my grandfather's farm. We moved in the middle of winter, just before Christmas, 40 miles through deep snow, and we kids kept singing Christmas carols all the way down because we were scared, actually, of the snowbanks.
Why was it scary?
There was a section halfway down through these town called the 9 Miles Woods, and there were legends about people who were being held up there or cars breaking down and nobody coming to help and dying in the snowbanks, and there were big snowbanks on both sides of the road. And it was scary. But I want to tell you about the end of the trip. There was a big hill coming down into the town of Mattawamkeag, and it was just a little bit before Christmas, and it had been dark all the way and scary. The only thing that kept us happy was Christmas carols. We came to the top of the hill, and we could see lights. And it was a town, and all I could think of was the little town of Bethlehem, and it took care of all that. The hard feelings. Excuse me.
So did you sing A Little Town of Bethlehem?
We were singing. I started singing by myself. I was just 8 years old, and I started the singing. And my other two brothers and sister were with me, and we were all singing, going down. But I would like to tell you about going into town. We had no place where we were going to live. And the street lights were there. We came to the town. There were two or three stores in town. It was a small town. Lights were on. We started out of town, and there were still the street lights, and pretty soon the street lights ended. And still no place to stop. A little bit further on the road, the man turned the truck on a sort of unplowed road, and we went on that for quite a distance, and finally he came to a stop, and there was... It just looked like a shack, but there was a light in the window. It was a kerosene light. And my mother said, "Is this it?" And the door opened, and there stood my dad. That was the move. We were there. It was a 24 by 12, what they called a tar paper shack. There were not all seven of us at that time, but that was the place we lived in for the next 8 years, and
so
with bunks along the wall. And
how many people lived in that place?
Well, there were seven of us children eventually, and my mother and father, 9 of us who lived in that for 8 years.
Where did you all sleep? It was such a small place.
We had double bunks built along both sides of the wall. We had a stove in the middle, which was the cook stove and the heater stove. And that's about all that we had. We went to the toilet out in another little shack quite a ways from the house. We got our drinking water from a spring in the woods, and we were happy. We were a happy family. We had almost nothing, but, well, the one thing we did have was an old wind-up Victrola, though. That was my first musical instrument that I used to play.
What were the songs you used to listen to on it?
Kind of songs?
Yeah.
Well, they were records in those days that came out. Some of them were cowboy song records, and a few of them were hymns and that sort of thing, and what they called the popular songs of those days, which are no longer popular, but that's all we had, was that kind of music. And that's what I learned to sing by, was those. I always sang. When I worked on the railroad some years later, I used to sing the song, "I've Been Working on the Railroad." And that was a great part of my youth, because I lived not very far from the railroad, and it was, no, but that's just one of the songs I remember.
Yeah. But you, speaking of the railroad, I didn't think that it was all that close to your house, because didn't you say that you had
it was within a quarter of a mile from the house. The railroad station was probably more like a half a mile. But
when you worked on it, didn't you stay in?
Oh, no. When I worked on the railroad, I was in high school, and I went to work on what they call the extra gang, which was the crew that laid new steel all over. No, I was 45, 50 miles from home on the Canadian Pacific Railroad, and working with the extra gang laying steel. So I had to get a ride on the back end of a train on Sunday nights to get to work on Monday mornings. And then when the job was over on Saturdays, I'd get a ride on a boxcar coming back home. And that was my transportation, but I wasn't alone.
What was that like, working on the railroad?
Well, I look at it in two ways. It was the hardest work that I ever did. But also there was something good feeling about it. Construction, I always liked. And we knew that we had to do a good job, because if it didn't, they would have railroad accidents and this sort of thing. The hardness of it was, well, the kind of work that we did. We were laying steel, laying 32-foot pieces of railroad steel, had to put the ties in the ground, and you had to use a 10-pound sledgehammer to drive the spikes to put the clamps on. I was just 16 years old, and the big job was driving the spikes, and that's what I wanted to do, because I was just a boy becoming a man. But it was the hardest work I ever did, and blisters on my hands the first night. I didn't think I could do it the next day, but in my life, I've always been determined. If I had to do something, I was going to do the best that I could.
So they let you work at 16?
Yeah. I was supposed to be 18, they told us, but they were hard up for labor back in those days, particularly on the extra gang, because it was hard work. But you could lie your age, and they would hire you. And if they asked you your age, you were 18. But you didn't have to tell the truth. There were several of us boys laying steel, and quite a few older men who were, some of them, were, we called them hobos in those days. They went from one place to another in the summertime just to find work. And it was an interesting mixture, because there were two different breeds of cats, you might say. I mean, these were men who had seen the world, and oftentimes would try to get some liquor or something and smoke, and none of us did all of those things, but we lived with them. It was a good example of what life can be like, I guess.
Did you have any friends on the extra gang in particular that you remember?
Yeah, there were just two others of us from Mattawamkeag. So we had some companionship, and we would ride the boxcars or whatever ride we could on Sunday nights, and then we'd come back on Saturday. We got paid $12 a week. We worked 12 hours a day for 5.5 days. Got $12. Used to get paid in silver dollars, American silver dollars, the Canadians would pay off in American cash. But when I got home, my father wasn't able to work. He'd had a bad woods accident, and he had no money coming in. So when I would get home, I would give my dad $10 out of my 12. I felt real good about that. But I had a little dance band, too, and we used to play for the dancers Saturday night at the Grange Hall. And we got paid $5 for 4 hours of playing. So I had a lot of money, all I needed to. I wanted to help my family, and that was the way we were brought up. We were a family. That was important to us.
Tell me about your dad.
My dad was a Canadian boy at the age of 14 who came over to work in the Maine woods. That was typical of the Canadian men in those days, in large families, particularly if they owned a family farm. The farm would eventually go to the oldest son, and the other boys had to go out and try to find work. And he already had two uncles who had done the same thing, come into Maine to work in the woods. One of them was killed in a log drive. So my dad came over, and his first job was a cookie in a lumber camp way up north of Patton. And a cookie, you know what, they're a cook's helper. They do all the dirty work. But then he became what's it called, a chopper. He was a good axe man. And that's long before the chainsaws came in. It was axe and saws, everything, in cutting the wood. But it was interesting in life because the loggers would go into the woods in September, and they wouldn't come out until April with the log drive. And then they had to find work to do for the summer. And instead of going all the way back to Canada, he looked for a job on a farm, and he found a job on my grandfather's farm. And that's how he met my mother. And that's a beautiful story. That's my dad. He went on to be a construction man, and he worked on building dams in the state of Maine. And when World War II started and all of us went off to war, he went to South Portland, Maine, and worked in the shipyard and built ships. And he was so proud of those because he could do something for his sons, I think. That's what he...
Did he ever show you how to make something? Or?
Ah, yes, as a matter of fact. A willow whistle. Did you ever hear of a willow whistle?
Most people
never heard of them. Well, a willow tree puts off nice little branches, and you get one that's maybe an inch or 2 inches in diameter like that, and you cut a section off it off, maybe 6 inches long. He had a way of, you cut these in the springtime because that's when the sap is flowing, see? You cut these in the springtime, and then with his jackknife, he would cut around the bark so he could slip it off one end, and then he would make a groove in that, and then he would slip it back on, the bark cover. And in that, he would push a little pebble, okay? And when you blew into that, it would whistle, and the pebble would jump up and down, like that. He made willow whistles for half the kids in the town of Mattawamkeag. He also showed me how to make bows and arrows. We had no money, so we used to play, well, cowboy and Indian, we played a lot, but he could make a pretty good bow and arrow just with a string and, you know, a branch of a tree and make the arrows. And, oh, Lordy, what else did he make? Oh, so many different things. He made toys. He used to make tops for us out of spools. You could take a spool and whittle it down to a point like this and put a little peg in there and then put a nail in the top of it and wind a string around it, and you set it down and pull the string in the top. We had lots of tops. I can go on and on thinking of things. I can't think of any more right now. But
what else did you used to do with your dad?
Everything. Well, we used to play horseshoe with him all the time. I mean, that was how I learned to play horseshoe. But Dad would take me for walks in the woods. And, of course, he was a woodsman, and he loved the woods. And he taught me that, too. I love the woods. But he would, oftentimes, I'd be riding on his shoulders, and we'd be walking just softly. He taught me how to move through the woods without making any sound, because he said that was the way that the Indians had to do that, to sneak up on the game and their deer. But I remember several things about, he'd be walking along through a woods, and all of a sudden he'd stop and go like that. And then we would move on. The minute we would move on, off would go a partridge, taking off, scaring the life out of you. But he knew it was there. He just sensed those things or heard enough movement. And that he also showed me how to find drinking water, what to drink and not. As a matter of fact, we had no well in the shack we lived in. We had a spring out in the woods that he dug. He showed me how to hunt and how to fish and how to sneak up on deer rather than the way of taking a stand where the deer run and wait until one comes by and then killing it. His way of hunting was finding the deer, going where they were. And he taught me how to hunt. And I killed, I think, 9 deer in my lifetime. half of which we used for food, and that was why we killed them. I didn't like to kill deer. I never liked to kill anything. My friend was Joseph Henry Marshall. He went by the name of Henry. And I remember so many things about him. People would ask me when I was a kid, who's your dad? And I would say, Henry Marshall. And they would say, oh, he's a good man, or he's a good worker. And in those days, that meant so much. It was the best thing you could say about people was they're a good man or a good worker. He taught me so many things that I just don't remember them all, but those are the outstanding things. He taught me how to fish, how to stand on the side of a stream so you didn't scare the fish and you could get up to where they were. And he taught me the love of woods, too. I've always had a saying that a tree, which I do, I cut all my own firewood, but I hate to cut them down. They're alive. And when I would look at a tree, and he taught me this, it was alive. It was not like a human being, but it was a life. And I always felt badly about cutting down a tree. But I eventually became a forester. I have a degree in forestry, and I loved the Maine woods. I went back into them in the areas where my dad was a boy as a logger. And I felt, he's here. I used to have that kind of a feeling. He's here.
Had he died at that point?
Pardon?
Had he died at that point?
Yes, yeah. Well,
when did he die?
Yes, and no, he didn't die just then. That was right after I got out of college. And he died about, let me think, I have to stop and think, 49. He died about 15 years later. He was 95 when he died. But he had worked on construction, heavy building construction, working on dams right up until about 8 or 10 years before. He never really retired. He loved work, and he loved working with men. He had a great respect for other people. And it was strange. Dad very seldom, well, he almost never went to church when we were young. But of all the Christian people I know of, he was one. He used to make axe handles when we would all go off to church in the morning, Sunday morning. My dad would go in the woods and cut a piece of an ash tree to make an axe handle. And while we were in church, he'd make an axe handle. He sold some of them, but some of them he just gave away. He just had a knack and a love of working with his hands and with wood, particularly because he had a love of wood similar to what I have, I guess, or I got it from him. So,
can you describe him to us?
Well, there are people who say that I look like him, but he was quiet. He loved to whistle. He taught me how to whistle. Well, he didn't teach me. I learned from him how to whistle.
Can you whistle for us?
Red out of breath. He was a good man. He would help anybody, not charge anything. Elderly ladies living alone would have a broken window, and they'd call Henry Marshall, and he'd fix it. I played baseball a lot out on the town lot, and oftentimes I'd hit a ball, and it would go through somebody's window, and they knew my dad would fix it. I guess I can't say enough about him, but simple stuff, but he was a good father. He hated to see his boys go off to war, but he felt like he was doing his part by building ships, the Liberty ships. I don't know how many of them got sunk by U-boats crossing the Atlantic, but that's my ship, he would say. The work he had worked on when it was launched. That my ship, I'll launch my ship. So,
If he were here, if he were alive, what would you ask him?
I never really, and I regret this terribly, I never asked him about his feeling about his experiences. I would like to have heard him tell more about how he felt when he left home. When he first left home, two of his sisters had gone to Boston and had worked to work in some factory, and they met some men who had some money, so they thought they had some money, at least they had a home. They sent for him to give him an education, and they put him into what they called a mechanic school, which was to train the conductors for the L's, the big railroads. He hated it. They gave him enough money to go back home alone. And he got as far as Bangor, Maine, and his money ran out. He still had to get to Canada. He heard that they were hiring men to work in the Maine woods, and he went to one of the organizations that hired loggers, and if they hired you, they would pay your way to get to the woods. And that's how he got into the Maine woods. He never went home again until he was several years, and finally when he met my mother, who was a farmer's daughter, and got married on their honeymoon, they went back to Canada. And his father was still alive. He was an old man, but and there's another. He's talked a little bit about his boyhood in Canada, even as in his start of his teens, they had to take military training, and he told me that when the war started, about how he had military training with a wooden rifle and everything else, but because he never had to go. I'm sorry, I went too far. But Dad never talked much. He was a cribbage player, and he taught all of us in the family to play cribbage, and it's still my favorite game. Do you play cribbage by any chance? No. I will teach you someday. I've taught a lot of people how to play cribbage.
For those of people who don't know what cribbage is, can you describe it?
Yeah. It's a family game in a sense. Families who play cribbage, almost everybody does. You use a board called a cribbage board, and it's got pegs, holes in it with the pegs, and you play cards, and each card that you play and a combination of cards will give you points. And you have to run 121 points on the point on the card in order to win. And It's an interesting mental name, because you have to do a lot of thinking about the combinations of how to use the cards and how to play them and everything. So it's a very challenging. It's an arithmetical game, too. You have to be able to add quickly and move this. And usually parents will teach their children how to play cribbage. That's how other people know how. Usually it's taught as a kind of a family game.
So did you guys play cribbage when you were growing up in the tar paper shack?
Oh yes, yeah, we could all play cribbage, yeah, every one of us, and that was the only game we ever played. It was kind of funny though, my mother had never played anything else, but when I went in the war I learned to play poker, and my mother during World War II was head of the hostesses at the USO in the Portland Station, Portland, Maine, and she met hundreds and hundreds of boys in the Navy, everybody coming and going, and they taught her to play the poker. I didn't know that. When I came home and was going to teach her how to play poker, she she said, "I think I know how." And she did. She could win. So we didn't play much cribbage at that point, but that was the family game. And it's a very interesting game, because the cribbage board, I have one that's made out of a chunk of wood, a slab of wood that's circular, and the pegs go round and round. Other people have cribbage boards that are big, sort of like coffee table size, large size, and it's a fascinating game. Everybody should learn to play cribbage. It takes a lot of mental skill, and it's much more fun than poker.
How did you learn how to play poker?
If you're in the military, you're sooner or later going to play poker. That's the only game. That was the only game. And then Pinochle came out. When I was in Europe, every one of us had a Pinochle deck, and the minute we stopped, we'd play Pinochle. I don't even remember how to play anymore, but it became the game, Pinochle. But poker was a quiet game. You had to have space and time to play poker. The other game that you could play anywhere, on a floor, on the street, was dice, shooting dice. And I never got into that. I never liked it, so I just never played it. But poker was another mental game. It took a lot of skill to win at poker. Those are the only games that I ever played. Well, used to play some rummy, finally, and a few kind of games like that. But.
Is that how you kept yourself entertained during the war?
Yes. The word entertained, I guess, kind of stopped me there for a moment, because whenever we would stop fighting and moving and digging in a hole in the ground, the most important thing was try to get some sleep. But there were times when you couldn't, and I've been in shelled out houses where when we couldn't sleep, we'd put out a deck of cards and play some poker if we could see. Pinochle, two guys could play Pinochle. Well, two guys could play poker, but usually there were several. Yeah, it was a relief, I guess, of fear and to have your mind on something else and when you couldn't sleep. I didn't know anybody who couldn't play Pinochle, for example. We all learned it one from another. No such thing as solitaire in those days. It was before computers came out and you can play the cell game or something like that, which I now play on computer.
So what were you doing in World War II? What was your role?
In the military?
Yeah.
Well, it's kind of a long story. I'll try to make it short. First of all, I had bad eyesight when I was a child. My other brothers had all joined the Air Force. I wanted to go in the Air Force, but they wouldn't take me because they couldn't see. I wanted to go in the Navy, and they couldn't see. So I couldn't enlist. When I was drafted, they put me in the infantry. Trained in the infantry, and there was nothing about it that I liked, and I used to not worry but think about having to kill somebody, and that always bothered me. And about a month before we were to go over to Europe, my captain called us out to see if any of us would volunteer to become what we called a combat medic. In the rifle platoon of 40 men, there was one man whose job was to try to keep the other guys alive long enough so that litter bearers could get them, carry them back to an aid station and give them then and the first doctor they came to. Nobody wanted that job, and they could have forced you into it because that's the Army had that way, but I volunteered because I think, well, I could save lives instead of having to kill anybody. I had very little training. There was nothing you could do. The training basically was to stop the bleeding, because if you could stop the bleeding, then the guy would live or had a good chance of living. All we had was big Band-Aids to carry, and if a wound, no matter what the size of it, you tried to plug it off and tie it off. And that's what I did, was a combat medic.
And so where were you in the war?
In France, in Holland, in Belgium, in Germany. In almost constant combat or under shelling, or I think the longest we had maybe was a week and a half one time when we were just sitting and waiting, or we might be in reserve for 2 or 3 days, but we were still in the combat zone. And whenever we were called for, even in reserve, off we would go. We had to be ready all the time. It's no such thing. So I saw a lot of all of those countries, a lot of destruction of them, a lot of destruction of the beauty of the European towns and cities and places like that. And bridges that stick out in my mind, hundreds of bridges. I never saw a standing bridge until they captured the one at Remagen on the Rhine River. And it was the last bridge on the whole Rhine River that was standing. And I got across on that one. Otherwise, we would have had to go on ponton boats, which we did on smaller rivers. We had to go by boat. That's what I did.
What were some of the good memories from World War II? Was there anything positive?
Well, in combat or outside of combat, they were all good memories before I got into combat. In combat, I had tried to think of a few that were pleasant. Unusual, I guess. I was a farm boy. I was brought up on my grandfather's farm, and when we were in Holland, we were bombing and shelling, and so were the Germans, and the beautiful farms of Holland were being destroyed, and you could look out into a field, and you would see 20 or 30 cows lying belly up, all killed by the shells, and you might see an elderly man and woman standing by what was the remains of their farm, and when we were under heavy shelling, we'd try to find shelter. And one night, we found what was the remains of a barn and had some hay, and we were trying to get some sleep when we'd just gotten into it when we heard horrible bellowing. And one of my buddies from, I say he was from New York because they were kind of loud guys more than us Maine guys, but what in the hell is that? And I said, those are cows. Yeah, shoot the damn thing so we can get some sleep. I said, no, they want to be milked. Yeah, who's going to milk them? I said, I will. When I went out, I took off my helmet, and I milked three cows and took them back to the boys. Fresh milk. I mean, they couldn't believe it. So that was a happy time. And yeah, there were a few other times, but... Not very many. I also killed a goose one time and cooked it for my boys. And we first time we'd had any fresh meat for a long time. There weren't very many times like that. They were. I think sometimes I felt. I patched up two or three, or maybe four German soldiers that were wounded and. Made me feel that I was helping people rather than killing them, and that meant a lot to me, I guess.
Was there a moment during World War II that, a moment for you where you were, of something that you were proud of?
That I was proud of?
Yeah.
Mm. Well, guess I don't like to use the word proud, but happy that I could do it. The war was beginning to close a month or two before it did close, and we were approaching the Elbe River, and the Elbe River had been declared as the stopping points for the Russians coming from the east and the Americans and British coming from the west, and they were supposed to stop 20 miles each side of the river, so it was a no man's land, and there wouldn't be any connections with any of the various troops, and so we were not supposed to get any. We had been stopped, and my captain had an idea that he would like to have some of his men be the first ones to meet the Russians. So he asked for five men to go on what was called a sneak patrol through the last about 20 miles between there and the Elbe River, thinking that there might be some Russians who would also come to the Elbe River. And they wanted a medic to go along with them, and so I volunteered. And We went by night and what little daylight we could, because we were still meeting up with Germans, but most of them were wanting to surrender. They were tired of the war, except the elite troops of Hitler, who were the SS troops. They were dedicated to die. And I went on that and succeeded, met some Russians at the Elbe River. And we thought we were the first ones, but other outfits had done the same thing. I was pleased to be able to do that. I don't say pride, but maybe it would be called pride. But yes, that was it, yeah.
Is there any way that you would like to conclude the conversation?
I guess what I would like to say, war is a horrible thing. I hate to see people wave flags and make a big deal out of it, where so many hundreds and millions of us got killed and so many millions of people got killed. And those of us who saw that, I saw concentration camps with stacks and stacks of bodies that were there. And any way that we could possibly stop that kind of killing, I think we should do everything in our power to do it, and our government should do everything in their power to do it. And we should not think of hating people, because the German soldiers, most of them, felt just like I did. I would see guys who looked just like me, different. They didn't want to fight either, but our saying was, we did what we had to do, and we were not proud of it, not those of us who saw horrible death and killing. We were not proud of it.
Maybe by doing this, by telling your story, that'll maybe help to teach other people to not do it.
Interesting thing when I talk with other veterans and I talk about the war, or I talk about someone whose father might have been in the military, they say, well, my dad never talked about it, and neither did I, until I got started trying to write something about it. We were not proud. Those of us who saw hell were not proud of it. We didn't want to bring it back. You can see I have trouble talking about it because it becomes real to me again. But I'm trying to put it into a book form that others can read and know what it was all about, not just for me, but for millions of us boys. I'm in hopes to use a title something like Maine Boy Goes to War. I was a loving Maine boy and brought up in a loving family and suddenly had to go out and kill people. What a change. And we don't get over that very easily.
I just want to thank you for coming in and sharing. Thank you so much.
Well, I hope I did something that's worthwhile, but I sometimes get choking up and I don't... Thank you.
Thank you.
You've